Right, Madam Chair, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Good morning and welcome back to the third day of Portola South Construction Site, ACL complaint number Regional Board 9-2020-006. Will the clerk please call the roll?
I will. Mr. Barbanel? Not here yet. Mr. Anderson?
Here.
Ms. Blair? Not here yet. Dr. Olson?
Here.
Mr. Strawn?
Here.
Ms. Warren is not here yet. Chair Cantu?
Here. We have a quorum. We anticipated some absences this morning, and they will catch up on their own time. We are able to proceed, nevertheless. We want to start by announcing remaining time for both parties. And I'm not exactly sure who is prepared to do that, but whoever is ready to do that, please do so now. Well, you either have no time or all the time in the world. Here we go.
I can look that up if the timekeepers don't have it handy. So I just need a minute to find the email.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm ready. It's an hour and 42 minutes and 10 seconds remaining for the dischargers and 45 minutes and 30 seconds remaining for the prosecution team.
Very good. And I'll note that Ms. Blair has joined us. Thank you. We ended yesterday with Mr. Schneider, and I believe we completed our process. I don't think I invited questions from the advisory team for Mr. Schneider, and I just don't remember if I did that or not. I didn't, my notes don't reflect. But if there's no objections, we'll continue with a discharger's case. And I believe, Mr. T, you have some more witnesses.
Yes, Madam Chair, good morning. And we would call Mr. Randall Bone as our next witness. I believe he's online, hopefully. And he is not, I don't believe he's taken the oath. So we need to handle that with him and then we can get him started.
Randall Bone has been promoted and is able to share his screen.
Mr. Bone, good morning. Will you please raise your right hand? Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is the truth? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go ahead and proceed. Good morning, sir. Can you please state your full name for the record?
Randall Bone.
Sir, can you briefly describe your educational and professional background for the board?
Yes, I did undergraduate at UCLA in the late 80s, early 90s. I then worked in real estate development and real estate finance. I went to business school in the late 90s at Harvard, and after that, rejoined construction and development since that time.
Since the late 90s?
Yes.
Okay, so you've been involved in the land development business since that time frame?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, I want to get right to the Portola South project because we have limited time here today. Can you tell us how you first became involved with the Portola South project?
Yes, a bank, First Bank, went to market with a portfolio of loans that included a loan on the Portola South project. We bid against a bunch of people and acquired that loan portfolio, and then acquired the property and a number of other properties in a deed in lieu of foreclosure proceeding.
Can you give us the approximate time frame for when that Portola South property was acquired?
Late spring of 2010, I believe.
And you mentioned, you used the term we acquired. Was there a particular company that you were referring to?
Yeah, Sun Ranch Capital Partners.
And just so we're clear on the record, and it's a lawyer habit, but the company you're referring to is Sun Ranch Capital Partners, LLC, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. I'm going to just, to try to spare having to say all those words every time, I'll just call that Sun Ranch. Is that fair?
Okay.
Okay. So have you been affiliated with Sun Ranch since that time frame back in 2010?
Yes.
And how are you affiliated with that company, sir?
I am the manager of ASSR Pacific Investments, LLC, and that company is the manager of Sun Ranch.
Have you ever served as a manager of Sun Ranch directly?
I don't believe so, no.
To your knowledge, the company you just mentioned, ASSR Pacific Investments, is that the company that's always served as the manager for Sun Ranch?
Yes.
Okay. Now, back to the 2010 timeframe, you said it was spring of 2010 when Sun Ranch acquired Portola South. What was the condition or, you know, development status of the property at that time?
It was undeveloped piece of land.
Okay. Did your company, did Sun Ranch undertake to obtain development entitlements for the property?
Yes.
Can you provide the board with a brief overview of what was involved in that process?
The entitled process involved working with the City of Lake Forest and a number of government agencies, California Department of Fish and Wildlife and federal agencies, to obtain the permits and permissions to develop that property.
Now, do you have a general recollection? At some point, you were permitted to go forward with construction on the site, right?
Yes.
Do you have a general recollection of when that occurred?
I believe the final permits were issued in the summer of 2015, I believe. Okay.
And then we've already heard testimony that grading activity started in that late summer timeframe. Is that consistent with your recollection?
Yes.
Okay. Now, from that summer 2015 timeframe forward into 2016, do you recall who the general contractor was for the construction activities that occurred on the project?
Yes, Sunrise Pacific Construction. It's a California corporation.
Is that another company that you are affiliated with in some manner?
Yes.
How are you affiliated with that company, sir?
I'm a 50% owner of that company, and I'm the vice president of that company. I'm an officer.
Okay, so you're both an owner and an officer of Sunrise Pacific Construction.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's get back to the time that construction started. Sunrise Pacific is acting as a general contractor. Can you tell the board specifically what was the role of Sunrise Pacific Construction's general contractor for those grading activities?
So a general contractor hires a bunch of subcontractors to do specific pieces of work that they specialize in. And then the general contractor manages the subcontractors to get the work done.
Now, does the general contractor also interface with city representatives?
Yes.
Okay. And does the general contractor generally sort of oversee and manage the subcontractors who are doing the various specific tasks on the job?
Yes.
We've heard a lot about a lot of talk about the construction schedule on the project. Does the general contractor, in this case, Sunrise Pacific Construction, did it have a role in developing a construction schedule for the project?
Yeah. The general contractor develops the schedule.
Okay. And in fact, in this case, do you recall that Sunrise, I mean, there was a schedule. Sunrise Pacific Construction developed a schedule for construction activities?
Yes.
Okay. Now, who prepared? What people or persons prepared the schedule?
Well, the construction team, there's a number of people on the team work with the subcontractors to look at the individual pieces of work and how they relate to each other and what time frame it will take and, you know, people, materials, equipment to get the different pieces of work done. And then they build with them a kind of a detailed flow schedule. That would have been originally Gary Berger was running the construction team. And then he retired I believe that fall, and Jose Capati, who had been his number two, took over as the lead of the construction team.
So I take it that group, Mr. Berger in particular and Mr. Capati, were involved in developing the construction schedule?
That's correct.
Did you participate in development of the construction schedule?
I don't directly build the schedule. I see it, they present it and walk us through it, but no, I don't work in the construction team.
Do you have a recollection of that time frame and what the anticipated schedule was for construction activities on the project, specifically as it related to, you know, the start clearing and grubbing through the mass grading process?
Clearing, grubbing, and mass grading. That would have been around maybe 6 or 8, 9 months.
And was the schedule that was planned for grading activities, and I include clearing, grubbing, because that's the precursor to grading, but that process, was it considered by the construction team or by you as one of the owners of Sunrise Pacific Construction to be an accelerated or rushed schedule?
No.
Okay.
No.
Was there actually a document, a construction schedule document that was created?
Yes.
All right, let me show you a document we have. It's going to be, we'll try to get this on the screen for you. It's going to be exhibit, prosecution team exhibit 195. And this is exhibit L to that, I'm sorry. It's an exhibit L to an exhibit. So sorry for the confusion. It's page 149 of exhibit 195. And hopefully you can see this document on your screen, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. This was the schedule, at least, that was included in the GMAX contract between Sunrise and LSOC. Do you recognize this generally?
Yeah.
Does this appear to be the schedule for the project?
Yes.
And when we see the highlighted parts, that's because I highlighted them, because I want to make sure everybody could see what I was wanting everybody to note, that the schedule showed clearing and grubbing and rough grading. Rough grading is the same thing as mass grading?
Yes.
Okay. So clearing and grubbing and rough grading were combined scheduled to take, it looks like 182 days. Is that what you recall as well?
Yeah, that sounds right. That is right.
Now, when you see a schedule like this, do you have a general understanding that you're not anticipating grading every single day of the week or the month or the year, correct?
Correct.
So this 182 days is spread out over a longer actual calendar period than 182 days because there are off days or off and down days built into the schedule?
Yes.
Okay. Now you mentioned Mr. Berger. Do you recall we can take this down. I just want to make sure we share. I don't think the board has seen the schedule yet. I wanted to share it. You mentioned Mr. Berger, his role before he retired was what? What was his role with Sunrise Pacific Construction?
He had been in charge of our construction operations and many different projects for many years, very experienced guy. And he, for Sunrise Pacific Construction, he was in charge of the construction of the project and the construction team.
And then you mentioned Mr. Capati, and he was an employee, right?
Yes.
I mean, Mr. Capati wasn't an owner, like unlike you. I mean, he wasn't an owner or a corporate officer or anything like that.
No, he wasn't.
What was Mr. Capati's role on the construction team, sir?
He was originally under Gary Berger. He was the number two on-site construction guy who managed all the subcontractors on-site every day. And then when Gary retired, he took on the entire role of being the head of the construction team.
Do you have an understanding of Mr. Capati's, you know, general background and qualifications?
Yeah, he's been in construction and land development for many, many years, has also worked on a number of projects for us over the years.
Do you also understand he's a licensed engineer?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I don't think you've mentioned this name, but do you recall a gentleman named Joe Giedemann serving as the project superintendent?
Yes, that sounds right.
And then I'm just going to throw another name out there, and that's Cameron Mann. There's already been testimony that he was the project QSP. Do you recall Mr. Mann?
Vaguely, to be honest.
Okay. Now, that brings up a point. You were not present out on the site during construction activities as a regular occurrence. Is that true?
That's correct.
That just isn't part of your scope of what you're doing.
Correct.
Now, there's somebody else we haven't mentioned, and I have a list. I just want to make sure we get everybody. That's Mr. Baldwin, Sean Baldwin.
Yes.
What was Mr. Baldwin's role? And we have to be careful that we're talking about Sean Baldwin, because there are other Baldwin folks that we've identified. But Sean Baldwin's role with Sunrise Pacific Construction.
Sean Baldwin is the other owner of Sunrise Pacific Construction, and he's the president and manages the day-to-day operations of Sunrise Pacific Construction.
So is it fair to say in that role, he would have been the one that would have received the reporting from either Mr. Berger or Mr. Capati?
That's correct.
Okay. And then did you also have opportunities to meet sort of collectively as part of the ownership group with the construction team during the course of the project?
Yes, we had regular team meetings.
Okay. Now, soon after construction started, and I believe it's July 29th, 2015, the record shows that Sun Ranch conveyed ownership of the Portola South property to another company, and that company is called SRC PH Investments LLC. That's another company that's named as a discharger here. Do you know who SRC PH Investments LLC is?
Yes.
Who is that company?
SRCPH Investments is a wholly owned special purpose entity owned by Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC. It's very standard, in fact, required by lenders and different people in the business, that when you move forward and start developing a property, you move the property into a single purpose entity that only owns that one property and is a subsidiary. And then all the operations and construction and sales activity and everything happens in a special purpose entity.
Now, not too long after that, moving forward a little bit in time, we moved to November of 2015. In fact, November 12th, to be specific. Do you recall that in that early November 2015 timeframe, SRCPH Investments, who now owned the property, conveyed ownership of the vast majority of the Portola South project to yet another company?
Yes.
Okay. What do you recall about that transaction generally?
We sold the property with the obligation to develop the property into finished lots for Lansi Company. It was a Chinese developer that was coming into the United States. And that was the closing on the property, and then Sunrise Pacific entered into a general contractor's agreement to build do the land development for them.
So SRCPH Investments LLC sold and conveyed ownership of the property to this third party company called Lansi.
Yeah, they had a special purpose entity, of course, too, that was like LSOC. Something like that, Lansi OC.
Okay, so after that November 12, 2015 date, did either Sun Ranch or SRCPH Investments LLC have any remaining ownership interest in the Portola South property?
Yeah, as part of that transaction, we retained a park site that needed to be finished and dedicated to the city. And we kept an affordable housing site that part of the entitlements we were required to build affordable housing on, and we kept that affordable housing site as well because Lansi didn't want to do the affordable housing or build the park.
So do you recall in general how large the whole Portola South site was?
It's just under 100 acres, I believe, 90 something acres.
And after that transaction in November of 2015, where the property was sold to Lansi, how much of the Portola South site, you just described the affordable housing and the park, how much did that comprise of the overall 90 plus acres?
Those two sites together are maybe 8 or 10 acres, something like that.
Okay, so after November 12, 2015, Landsea owned upwards of 90% of the property.
Right, and all the pieces of value too.
Right, right, because the park wasn't something that was going to be sold, right? It was going
to
be
built. Yeah, the park was something you have to spend money building and then give away, and the affordable housing costs more to build than it's worth too. So those are both losses.
So going forward from November 12th beyond, did Sunrise Pacific, I'm sorry, misspoke. From that November 12th date forward, did SRCPH Investments or Sun Ranch have any involvement with the Portola South project other than with the park site and the affordable housing site you just mentioned?
SRCPH Investments, no.
Okay.
Sunrise Pacific Construction was the general contractor.
Well, what about Sun Ranch?
No. Okay. Sun Ranch, not either.
So Sunrise Pacific Construction, and you already mentioned this, entered into that GMAX contract, the general contractor agreement with Landsea.
Correct.
That obligated Sun. Now Sunrise, beginning November 12, 2015, Sunrise Pacific Construction is working for Landsea, right?
Correct.
Under that, and it was, their relationship was governed by that GMAX contract.
Correct.
Okay. Now, do you understand whether Landsea or any of its affiliates, you mentioned an LSOC entity, did they have the right to, you know, come onto and access the Portola South property once they obtained ownership?
Yeah, of course.
Do you recall Sunrise Pacific Construction ever telling Landsea or LSOC they were denied access to come on the site? They weren't allowed to come on the project site?
No, I don't think that would have happened. I don't recall anything like that happening.
Okay. So again, we've been focusing on that November 2015 timeframe, and I want to move forward yet again into the December, late December in particular, and up to early January timeframe. Do you, and again, this is late 2015, early 2016, we're talking about, just to kind of give some bearings. Did you become aware of stormwater management issues or concerns on the project site?
Yes.
Can you tell us what you became aware of in general in your role?
Yeah, in our team meetings, they were reporting that the city inspectors had pointed out a number of deficiencies in the grading operations. And the team was frustrated that the grading contractor, you know, wasn't addressing them as quickly as we would like them to, and they were asking for more money, more help to go out and do work themselves and bring in other people and put pressure on the grading contractor to perform.
Now, as in your role, sort of at the ownership level, were you, you know, did you discuss those types of requests, budgeting and putting resources into BMP, or what, I'll use the term BMP, I don't even know if you're familiar with that, but stormwater management issues?
Yes.
Yeah, and so do you recall allocating resources to that, you know, that effort?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually.
Okay. I'm not going to try to take you through the amounts. The contracts are in the record and all. They're already part of the record, and I don't have time to take you through them all, but I mean, do you believe that Sunrise Pacific Construction, who was the general contractor in that time frame, took the stormwater management issues seriously?
Yeah, we took it very seriously. We were very worried and concerned that, you know, hillside grading operation like Portola South is a difficult and scary thing to do. We were very concerned and upset, and obviously that resulted in us eventually having to terminate the contract, general contractor, or the subcontractor that was doing the grading, and bring in somebody else.
So
just unusual.
Do you recall the name of the grading contractor who worked on the project?
Varner, I believe it was Varner.
And the evidence is already a record. Varner originally had a $6 million contract to conduct grading activities including doing BMP work. And I don't expect you to recall that amount, but you did just mention that ultimately Varner had to be fired and terminated. And that was a significant event to you?
Yeah, very. That's very unusual.
Was Varner replaced?
Yes.
Who, do you recall the name of the contractor who replaced Varner? You had to hire a new grading contractor. Is that the And I say you, I mean Sunrise Pacific Construction, right?
Yeah, we had to hire a lot of different folks to deal with this. But yeah, we ultimately ended up hiring a new grading contractor, and I can't recall which grading contractor that was, actually.
Fair enough. Sir, I just have a couple more questions for you, and then we can turn you loose and see if anyone else has any questions. Just some names, some company names that we've heard a lot about here. One of them is Baldwin & Sons, LLC. Are you familiar with that company?
Yes.
Have you ever had an ownership interest in that company?
No.
Have you ever been a member or manager of that company?
No.
Do you believe that company had any ownership interest at any time in the Portola South site?
No.
And do you know if that company's even is it a general contractor?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, let's talk about one more company, Baldwin & Sons, Inc. Are you familiar with that company?
Yeah, somewhat.
Have you ever had any ownership interest, direct or indirect, in that company?
No.
You've never been a shareholder of that company?
No.
Have you ever been a corporate officer for that company?
No.
All right, sir. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time this morning. Others may have questions for you, so please stick around. And I may have a couple more follow-up questions, but otherwise I'm completed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you. Board members, do you have questions for Mr. Bone? Ms. Blair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bone, for being with us. There was another grading company, and I'm going to probably butcher the name, but I believe it was Byteline. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
Byteline.
We've been, we have a lot of apologies on this board for mispronouncing names during this case. But do you recall why that company was let go?
I don't. That's if a bitch line. That seems like a pretty memorable name, but I don't recall that company now.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Do you remember the date that the Varner grading contract was terminated?
Per the terms of the contract, we had to issue like a notice of default. And then after that was not responded to adequately, we terminated that, I believe, was in early 2016.
Thank you. Prosecution team, do you have any objections to this witness?
No objections, just a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Bone. I believe Mr. T asked you if you ever directly managed Sun Ranch, and your response was no. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't believe that I ever managed Sun Ranch directly.
Okay. I'd like to pull up Prosecution Team Exhibit 269. Just one moment here. All right, can you see this okay?
Yes.
Okay, and would you agree that this is a Secretary of State Statement of Information filing?
Yes.
And is it for Sun Ranch Capital Partners, LLC?
Yes.
Okay. And then if we scroll down here under Chief Executive Officer, if elected or appointed, is that your name below?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then is it the case that Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC applied for permit coverage under the CGP or construction general permit?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Sure. Would you agree that Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC was the permittee under the construction general permit?
I don't know. That would be a construction team function.
Okay, well, just give me one moment here. I'm just going to pull up an exhibit here. All right, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Bear with me. Okay, can you see this okay?
Yes, now I can.
So would you agree that this is a notice of intent under the general permit, under the construction general permit, and it's a notice of intent to apply for the permit on behalf of Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC? You can see the name Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC over here.
Yep. I see notice of intent.
Okay.
Yeah. Notice of intent, and it shows the property owner as Sun Ranch.
Okay. Thank you. And I can't recall if Mr. T asked you this, so I'll just ask you this now, but were you ever a direct manager of SRCPH Investments, the other project owner?
I believe that the manager, I'd have to look at the documents, but typically the manager of SRCPH would be the owner, which was Sun Ranch Capital, and the manager of Sun Ranch Capital is ASSR.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and just share another exhibit here. Thanks for bearing with me. I'm almost done. Can you see this okay?
Yes.
Okay. And do you agree that this is a Secretary of State filing for SRCPH Investments LLC?
Yes.
Okay. And if we scroll down, under Chief Executive Officer, if elected or appointed, is that your name below?
Yes, but the manager is different than the Chief Executive Officer. Those are two different positions.
Okay.
Two different legal things.
Sure. Okay, and you stated to Mr. T that you were the director and vice president of Sunrise Pacific Construction, Inc., correct?
I don't know about director. I'm a half owner of that company, and I believe I'm the vice president of that company.
Okay, well, just to make sure we have everything straight here, I'm going to pull up one more exhibit.
Okay.
Okay, so this is another Secretary of State filing. Would you agree?
Yes.
And it's for Sunrise Pacific Construction. The ink is left off of here, but
okay.
I believe it's for the ink. See here. And then I just wanted to scroll down. Is this your name here under all directors, including directors who are also officers?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Would you say this is for the ink?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then would you agree that Sunrise Pacific Construction, Inc. was the general contractor during the relevant period for the complaint?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. And I'd like to pull up just one more exhibit. I believe this is one of the exhibits that Mr. T pulled up during your testimony already, so you may be familiar with it. So if we scroll up here, this is prosecution team exhibit 195. This is the GMAX contract. And I'd like to go to page 19 of the PDF. Oh, excuse me. Okay, so here we have the GMAX contract page 19 out of 162 on the PDF. And if we scroll down here to this section, can I have you, is this big enough for you to see? I can make it a little bit bigger.
Sorry, not being difficult. The page that came up first was a grant deed. Could you scroll up to the top of this document?
So sure. No problem.
So I know what I'm looking at.
Yes. No, thank you for looking that out.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. So do you recognize this to be the GMAX contract?
Yes, it appears to be, yes.
Okay. So now I'm going to scroll back down. Okay. And here we are. So this is page 3 of the GMAX contract for the record. And I'm going to zoom in a little bit. And do you understand the term contractor in this contract to mean Sunrise Pacific Construction, Inc.?
Yes.
Can you read this highlighted section out loud for me?
Contractor shall comply with any aspects of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, also known as the Clean Water Act, including Section 402P, which establishes a framework for regulating stormwater discharge under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, MPDES, program.
Okay, thank you. And then I'm just going to scroll down a little bit further into the contract. Again, thank you for being so patient. We're almost done here. And then can you see this page okay?
Yes.
Can you read that highlighted portion out loud for me?
Contractors shall be responsible to company for any acts and omissions of contractors, subcontractors.
Okay, and can you read the previous sentence?
Contractors shall ensure that subcontractors, subcontractors comply with all applicable obligations of contractor under the contract documents and applicable law.
Okay, thank you. And I just have, I think, one more question for you. So thank you for being so patient. And I'm gonna go ahead and share one more exhibit. This is prosecution team exhibit 334. Do you know what this document is, Mr. Bone?
It says application for section 401 certification for the Portola Center project, Orange County.
Okay.
So I know that much looking at it. I don't know what a Section 401 certification is.
Sure. Could you just read this first sentence right here?
Okay.
That I've highlighted.
UDEC is submitting this application for water quality certification on behalf of USA Portola Properties, LLC, Baldwin and Sons, and Sun Ranch Capital Partners, LLC, for the Portola Center project in accordance with Section 401 of the Federal Clean Water Act.
Great, thank you. And then I'm just gonna scroll down further into this exhibit. Okay, so here we are on page 13 of the application for Section 401 certification for the Portola Center project on behalf of the of Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC and the other entity. Could you go ahead and read this bullet point? Having trouble highlighting it, just this first bullet point right here.
Construction will take place outside of the rainy season, October 1st through March 14th.
Okay. All right, that is all for my questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Bum.
Thank you. Mr. T, do you have any redirect for Mr. Bone?
Yes, ma'am. Just a couple of quick items. If I could pull up Exhibit 334 again, I'll ask Ms. Teal to pull that up. I'm not asking you, Ms. Rubin. If Kendall can pull that up for me, I just have a couple quick questions about that document. Just starting on this first page, sir, have you ever seen this document before today?
I don't recall seeing this, no.
I mean, back in this is prepared 9 years, well, almost 9 years ago, a long time ago, it looks like, based on its date. Do you recall ever seeing this document before?
I don't recall seeing this document specifically, no.
Okay, now Ms. Rubin just asked you about that statement about that bullet point. I wanna show you a different part of this document. Looking at, it's gonna be PDF page 13 of this document. There's a heading, and we can highlight it maybe, I don't know if we can, 4.3 proposed schedule. It says the entitlement, I'm gonna read it just to save it. It's the grading is scheduled to begin in November 2013. Back then it was obviously delayed to another year, couple years, but grading is scheduled to begin in November 2013 with construction completed in December 2016. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
Now, did you ever understand that there was any limitation on whether grading was going to be allowed during, you know, the winter months or the rainy season?
No, that was never discussed.
Okay. All right, sir. Fair enough. That's all I have for you. Thank you for your time again.
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions from the advisory team of Mr. Bone? Hearing none, Mr. T, please call your next witness. Thank you, Mr. Bone.
Is he excused, Madam Chair, or does he need to stay online before he disappears?
I think he is excused. I'm okay. Sure you, if necessary, you would make your best efforts to retrieve him.
We can track Mr. Bone down if need be. Great. We planned on trying to call another percipient witness. I mentioned that last night when we wrapped up. The reality is when we looked at our budgeting time and the time constraints we have left, we do not really have time to pull that off effectively and meaningfully. So we are going to rest our presentation of evidence and reserve the rest of our time to present closing where I can sort of piece together the evidence that is in the record and what it means. So with that, thank you very much for your attention yesterday afternoon and morning and this morning.
Okay. Before we move into the next phase, let's take a 10-minute break. It's a little bit early, but I think it's well-timed. And we'll come back here at 9:54. Thank you. Before we ask Roger Mitchell if there's any registered interested parties, I'd like to ask the timekeepers to calculate remaining time and announce that after interested parties, if there are any, so that prosecution and the dischargers know what they have to work with for closing arguments. Roger, do we have any interested parties registered?
Thank you, Board Chair. I have not received the most recent list, and so I'll call upon Chris Blank, the board clerk, to identify if we've received any notifications.
Thank you.
The only notifications we've received are from the court reporters in the past couple of days. So we don't have any witnesses or any interested parties other than what was registered on Monday.
Okay, we have no interested parties. Fine. So we'll ask board members if they have any further questions for either the witnesses or the attorneys. And after that, we will announce time remaining for closing statements. Board members, do you have any questions, any further questions for the attorneys or witnesses? Hearing none, are the timekeepers ready to report remaining time available?
We are.
Oh, good.
The time remaining for the prosecution team is 35 minutes and 8 seconds. And for the dischargers, they have 1 hour, 17 minutes and 35 seconds.
Very good. So we will start with the prosecution's team closing argument.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that Board Member Henry isn't available, but I wanted to respond to a question he raised yesterday, and that was related to a comparison of the BMPs installed by dischargers to this action compared to Lansee, this purchaser of Portola South. That can be found in our technical analysis at footnote 15. I'm now just going to give a verbal closing. I kind of am tired of PowerPoints and charts, and you might be too. So let me dispense with one of the complicated legal matters that came up in this case. It is not in dispute that permittees Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC and SRC-PH Investments are liable for the violations. They should definitely be included on any order. However, we can't overstate how important it is in these types of cases that you also hold responsible those entities and individuals who actually manage the site, who decided to forge ahead with mass grading during the rainy season, who decided how much or how little to spend on BMPs. Baldwin & Sons, Inc., Baldwin & Sons, LLC, and Sunrise Pacific Construction, Inc. all must be held accountable for the manner in which they conducted operations at the site. These companies were the general contractors who hired the subcontractors and employed the on-site stormwater personnel. The initial contracts with Varner and Viceline were totally inadequate to cover the cost of protecting a 95-acre site with adequate BMPs. We know from later contracts that they were deficient by an order of magnitude. Mr. T questioned Mr. Baldwin about the Varner contract. At the time of the contract signing, it was approximately a $6 million contract for grading, and $55,000 was allocated for interior BMPs. The individuals, Jose Capati, Randall Bone, and Sean Baldwin, each held high-level positions that allowed them to influence corporate activities related to stormwater compliance. Jose Capati executed, amended, and subsequently terminated contracts with Varner. He had authority to commit more resources sooner in order to prevent or to correct the violations. Sean Baldwin was in a similar position and had an even higher level of contracting authority than Mr. Capati. Mr. Baldwin was the CEO of the general contractor during the entire violation period. He, of all people, should have taken aggressive action to deal with what they are now calling a rogue contractor, and he did not. And Randall Bone, who you heard from this morning, was the highest officer of the site owner and permittee. The buck stops with him. He is responsible for overall operations of the site and in a position to deal with Varner or any other contractor or subcontractor who was failing to comply with permits. And yet he couldn't identify what a 401 certification was, one of the controlling documents on the site. And it's one thing to say that it was several years ago. It's another not to have any idea what a 401 certification is. It's another to sit in front of a board with your attorney and not have been prepped on that particular matter of law. And so to show the board some respect and have him testify as to his knowledge of that, I think that was really disappointing. You've had a long 3 days, and yet I go back to one of my statements from my opening. This is a regular CGP case. It's a big one, but the issues are the same. The violations are the same. There are just more of them. Let me remind you that the San Diego Water Board staff exercises enforcement discretion on a daily basis, whether to pursue a matter, who to name, what violations to include, what penalty factors to select. Is this discretion unfettered? Absolutely not. It gets checked by their attorneys, both Office of Enforcement and Office of Chief Counsel, as well as considered for consistency both in their own region and among other regional boards. Furthermore, we work with an enforcement policy that establishes processes that force us to show our work. Prior to the 2010 enforcement policy, the prosecution team may propose a high penalty, the discharger would try to lower it, and the board would find a comfortable spot in the middle. Now we have significantly more transparency to demonstrate why we recommended a particular penalty. How many violations were there? What was discharged? How has the discharger responded? Those inquiries all help us line up and support an appropriate penalty. In this case, all of those considerations have been set forth in the technical analysis provided in January 2020. We included a chronology to demonstrate that we considered other enforcement actions before pursuing an administrative civil liability complaint against these particular dischargers. That chronology also outlined the responses of these dischargers to Lake Forest actions and then regional board actions. After numerous challenges to the investigation, the ACLC was ultimately issued after 3 years of the violation period. By that time, the south site had been sold and developed. Completed houses act as pretty effective erosion controls. But after all the delay and discovery battles, this hearing was extremely similar to all other ones we hear. The presentations were consistent with materials that have been in the record for months. Perhaps it changed your opinion to hear someone testify live, but the opinions have all been in the record and were allowed to be presented without limit of written documentation, supporting evidence, proof that they had done their best, any information related to we will do better next time. And the evidence of that is nowhere to be found. The discharger's positions have not changed since January 2021. Their experts conclude that there was little potential for harm, that the stream benefited from the sediment depositions, and that this was all a lot of fuss over nothing. Slap them on the wrist and be done with it. We've talked at length about the enforcement policy factors selected. Let me briefly remind you of some of the reasons why each party chose the factors it did. This summary appears in the prosecution team's rebuttal exhibit, as well as my opening statement. The potential for harm factor selected by the prosecution team was 2 to 4. We looked at previous stormwater cases and the amount of volume of material leaving the site. The dischargers gave the September discharge a 0 and the remaining dischargers a 1. You heard yesterday from Dr. Thatcher, and the conclusions were that the sediment-laden stormwater just wouldn't have traveled very far. And if it did, it was transient. The material would dilute in storm or creek water, and all would be well. Truth is, the receiving waters and their beneficial uses are right outside the construction boundary, so that material didn't have to travel far. And for the finer sediment that travels farther, as Dr. Thatcher explained, who knows where that ended up or what harm it did. I'm no biologist, but as I understand it, wildlife, one of our key beneficial uses, can cross watershed boundaries for foraging. And why are we looking at the dilution of the material in any event, and not the thing this board is created to protect, preventing the discharges? The prosecution's team started with the basin plan. Your advisory team took official notice of a principle that guides water board staff every day. The basin plan and construction general permit have the goal of preventing man-made sediment discharges. The prosecution team started with the permit and what it requires, the prevention of unauthorized discharges from the site. The dischargers took the opposite approach. Let's look at the creek 5 years later, and then let's zoom all the way out, all the way to the beach. Let's consider that there are a lot of other sediment particles in that creek. This project only accounts for 3 out of every 100. RINCON experts testified yesterday as to other enforcement policy factor decisions. You heard that Mr. Snyder reviewed photographs and determined what a reasonable and prudent person would do. He used his analysis to reduce the deviation from requirement from major to moderate in every category, as well as the culpability score. Did you find that persuasive? Did you find, when reviewing the 400th photograph cited in the technical analysis related to BMPs designed to prevent discharge, that the dischargers had only moderately deviated from the appropriate standard, that they really understood the permit requirements and came really close? Or did you tend to agree with the prosecution team's conclusion that more than 160 days of BMP violations rendered the permit directives irrelevant and therefore a major deviation? Now let's turn to the big albatross in the room, the volume discharge from the site. Again, keeping in mind that the Water Board's purpose is deterrence for both this discharger and other regulated entities, we didn't try to get the highest volume we could. The prosecution team tried to get what was accurate and fair, and I will detail that. At the time of his first volume memo, Mr. Elder relied on the storage capacity that should have been available based on the sediment basins identified in the SWIP, the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan. Mr. Elder also made conclusions about the soil type and rainfall information, not in a way to yield a higher penalty, but to accurately reflect what happened to all the rainwater. Based on rainfall gauge data, and this is consistent between the prosecution team and the dischargers, approximately 14 million gallons of rainfall fell from the sky between September and March. Where did that go? Was it captured on site through, hold on one second. One moment.
Let's take a quick 5-minute break so that the prosecution can recover. So 5 minutes from now would be 10:12. Thank you very much. It's 10:12 and our quorum is back. So let's proceed with Ms. Macedo.
Thank you, Chair. I apologize for the interruption and I will continue. We were talking about volume. We didn't try to get the highest penalty we could. We tried to get what was accurate and fair. At the time of his first volume memo, Mr. Elder relied on the storage capacity that should have been available based on sediment basins identified in the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan. These are basins that are designed by trained professionals. This is a document that is prepared by trained professionals to address vulnerabilities on the site. They are filed and available with all regional boards for projects in their region. Mr. Elder also made conclusions about the soil type and rainfall information, not in a way to yield a higher penalty, but to accurately reflect what happened to all the water. Based on rainfall gauge data, and this is consistent between the prosecution team and the dischargers, approximately 14 million gallons of rainfall fell from the sky between September 2015 and March 2016. Where did that go? Was it captured on site through ponding or absorption? Did it leave the site in violation of the CGP? Let's take a look at the various calculations different people made. Mr. Elder concluded that approximately 6.3 million gallons left the south site over the four events. Mr. Walker states that no more than 1.9 million gallons left because those intentional grading tracks hold water. You saw them in photographs yesterday. He can't say how much, but they hold something. Cameron Mann and Tommy Sue, the QSP and QSD respectively, Mr. Sue prepared the SWIP for this site, reported almost 13 million gallons left the site. So you have several estimates, 6.3, 13 million, 1.9 million. You have these estimates because the permit doesn't require the expense of constant monitoring and CCTV footage. Instead, we have discharger submissions. If you consider that 14 million gallons fell from the sky, and the QSP and QSD reported to the board that 13 million gallons were discharged, you can use that figure. Mr. Elder concludes that less than half of the stormwater was discharged, although still a significant amount. The discharger's current estimate of 1.9 million is less than 15% of the rainfall that fell from the sky. Do you look at the photographs and videos and conclude that the site was capturing 85% of its stormwater? If the Earth does such a good job of protecting herself and dealing with transient impacts, why do we need a stormwater permit at all? A few final points before I turn to policy arguments. The dischargers mentioned several times that Mr. Elder selected a curve number consistent with asphalt. The Portola South site is comprised mostly of clay soils. Clay is what is used to cap landfills to keep water out. Mr. Elder's selection was not designed to ratchet the volume up, but asphalt and clay are both pretty impervious. It's been lost in all the details, but the difference in what we were told about the project prior to construction and what happened is pretty significant. The three Portola Center sites are hydrologically connected. The south site receives runoff from Portola Northwest. Storage that might be available on site therefore has to contain a lot more than any expert is considering in his evaluation. Excuse me. This reduces the actual volume number. Mr. Walker admitted that he didn't analyze it. In any event, using any of the three volume figures currently in the record can get you to the same penalty. $10 a gallon when the dischargers admit that 1.9 million gallons were discharged gives you a $19 million ceiling. Using Mr. Walker's knob description, you can simply lower the volume knob, but turn up the per gallon knob. The prosecution team looked at the inputs and the outputs of the calculators and methodology used. To be honest, we didn't know for a long time what penalty we would recommend in this case. The dischargers complain that this is the largest stormwater penalty in the state for the CGP violations, and it is, but there have been many multi-million dollar settlements and orders for stormwater cases and SSOs in the past several years as we continue to assess penalties for volume. And we continue to argue that so much of that penalty is driven by factors within the discharger's control. We want them to show iterative improvement, and that often is sufficient. So how does the board figure out what it wants and what message it wants to send? We, the prosecution team, looked at the goal of stormwater program and the actions on site. Recall that this site had a 401 certification for extra conditions beyond the CGP. This was shown by Ms. Rubin in her cross of Mr. Bone this morning. The 401 wasn't the focus of this hearing, but the promises and assurance made to obtain and comply with that certification went unheeded. So let me be clear. Mr. Bone doesn't know what a 401 certification is, but his company said the right things to get the permit and then disregarded their conditions once he had it. You've heard about a rogue grading contractor and other BMP subcontractors. All of these contracts and change orders are in evidence. For example, Prosecution Team Exhibit 218, page 36, is the Varner contract for $6.1 million for grading. This included $55,000 for temporary erosion control for the entire violation period. $55,000, does that represent a dedication to prevention? Does it indicate that these discharges were unforeseen? Mr. Beislein was hired to install perimeter BMPs and said that discharges were doing their best, that they approved a lot of change orders for him. But he also admitted in his declaration that's in the exhibits, the prosecution team's rebuttal exhibits, that perimeter BMPs were inadequate to prevent discharges. See his declaration at paragraphs 7 and 9. However, Varner was allowed to grade almost all of the site for the entire violation period. In addition to Mr. Beislein, who was responsible for perimeter BMPs, the dischargers had to hire more contractors in March 2016. See Defense Exhibits 18 through 23 for companies known as LB3 and SoCal Sandbags. Dischargers spent more than an order of magnitude the initial amount assessed for BMP installation, trying to address the lack of interior BMPs. Yet none of those expenditures mitigated the impact of 6 million gallons of sediment-laden stormwater discharge. What size penalty would have compelled the dischargers to spend that money up front? To install the engineered sediment basins that were promised in the SWIP, instead of relying on tire tracks for storage. That's how the prosecution team approached its final penalty amount. The dischargers took another tact. You heard from Ms. Walsh that she was insulted by some of the dischargers' reactions. How do you feel about the dischargers' experts? Are their positions related to harm consistent with yours? How do you feel about Mr. Bone not knowing what a 401 certification is? Is 1.9 gallons of sediment-laden discharge over four rain events acceptable? Should it only be assessed a $40,000 penalty? Because that's what defense counsel's opening statement had for the 4 days of discharge. And notice how the focus is on the endpoint and not prevention. Where do we want to go and how do we get there? Your order will tell this discharger and the rest of the regulated community. A final note about process before I conclude. Certain comments were made about the inability of the regional board to be everywhere at once. Dischargers Council pointed out that the regional board didn't visit the site until after the four discharge events. It goes without saying that we have to rely on evidence of others, gathered by city staff on site or reported by the dischargers. Here, even that was challenged. Dischargers disavowed their initial reported volume estimates and challenged NOVs and stop work orders, saying some inspectors' daily reports indicated no observed violations. This case is full of evidence, more than we normally get. Dischargers seem to imply that using that evidence and not having a more formal hearing somehow violates their due process rights. Yet look at the process they have received. This three-day hearing did not include any new information that wasn't in the record. More than a year has gone by. All of the objections related to the staff's expertise compared to the discharger's experts is there for you to consider. I hope you saw via my cross-examination yesterday how siloed the discharger's experts were. Mr. Hromradka didn't even read Walker's analysis, so he has no conclusions on whether SWIM was appropriate or appropriately used.
Ms. Macedo, excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I see that our timekeeper has her hand up. Ms. Blank.
You are just under 10 minutes, Julie.
Thank you. I'm almost done. I appreciate it. Mr. Snyder considered risk and the anticipated rainfall for non-discharge events, violation categories 2 through 8. Dr. Thatcher analyzed fate and transport to determine that much of the sediment-laden stormwater didn't reach the creek. So he concluded that the violation of the CGP for that discharge is seemingly unimportant. In fact, he mistakenly asserted Aliso Creek and its tributaries don't even have beneficial uses at risk from too much sediment. You also saw lawyering in this case, and really why we should stay out of it. Is this case about Mr. Elder's understanding of the word final, even though he modified his conclusions and wrote a supplemental memo? Is it bad that he received the expert declarations from dischargers and modified his opinions? Isn't it the job of a public agency to continually reassess, affirm its conclusions, but be open to additional information? Is Kiara's assertion that she doesn't consider herself an expert prior to the ruling by the advisory team on this matter enough for you to reject her decades of experience? Or can you see through the lawyering to the facts of this case and the policies the board is upholding? I thank you for your attention, and I, along with any other member of the prosecution team, is available to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Ms. Macedo at this time from the board? Thank you. We'll invite Mr. T to do his closing for the dischargers. Mr. T?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go ahead. I hope the board can bear with me through one more PowerPoint because we do have one more. So I'll put that on the screen and I'll get started. Again, we're gonna start with this in non-presentation mode just because we're gonna click into some of the evidence, and initially we have to keep it in this mode. And then we'll switch into presentation mode in a few minutes or shortly. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair and fellow board members. We appreciate having the opportunity to have this hearing and to present evidence regarding our client's position to the board. Frankly, we appreciate having 6 hours, but it's not enough. It's not enough to get close to presenting all of the relevant evidence in this case. And what you've seen so far in the prior couple of days here really just scratches the surface of the evidence and the history of the Portola South project that we believe must be considered by the board to ensure that there is a fully informed decision here. I told you in my opening comments that my clients acknowledge there were significant shortcomings in the Portola South site regarding BMP management. We said that in the very first page of our opening brief, in fact, and we've never said otherwise. There were violations of the CGP on the project site. There were 4 days of discharge from the site, and those things have never been in dispute. As I mentioned in my opening comments, the focus of the evidence isn't on whether there were violations, because there were, and it isn't on whether there were 4 days of discharge, because, well, there was. The focus is on how much stormwater was discharged from the site on those 4 days, because that plays a pivotal role, a critical role in determining what is the appropriate penalty under the board's enforcement policy. And then secondly, as I mentioned in my opening, the second overarching question is, what enforcement policy scoring of the scoring factors is warranted by the evidence? And so we presented some of the key evidence on these topics through expert testimony and other witnesses, but there's much more that must be considered to make a decision. So I want to take the board through some of the important evidence, some of which has been presented during the past couple of days, but much of which has not yet been presented to the board, although part of the record. So we'll turn to the next slide, which is slide 2 in the presentation. And this is the start of a chronology. The next few slides are going to provide a chronology of important events and information relating to the Portola South site. So we start all the way back in 2010, and you heard Mr. Bone this morning. He testified that Sun Ranch Capital Partners acquired the property, the Portola South property, back in 2010. And as Mr. Bone testified, the entitlement process started after the property was acquired at that time. And then we see the next item. This is moving forward. We skipped 3 years, June 5th, 2013. And what we have here is Exhibit 334. And we'll go ahead and click on that. We saw that document a few minutes ago during examination of Mr. Bone. Again, this is a document that was an application for the 401 certification that's been mentioned. And as noted here, this is a document that was prepared by Dudek Consultants, a firm that I'm sure you all are familiar with, who prepared and assisted Sun Ranch and the other applicants, the adjacent owners of the adjacent property properties, the Portola Northwest and Portola Northeast projects. You heard testimony that the Portola South project encompasses about 95 acres. Now this document, the 401 application, is something that was submitted on behalf of multiple property owners for multiple different properties, and it actually encompassed a greater area of about 195 acres. And importantly, we looked at PDF page 13, and we'll go back to that. This is what Dudek Consultants, on behalf of the applicants in this case, presented to the board at that time. They presented an indication that at that time grading was going to begin in this is the actual section 4.3 is the specific provision that was presented regarding the proposed schedule. And the specific provision indicated very clearly that grading was intended to start in November 2013. And let's be clear, everybody knows that November is part of the rainy season. So we understand there was a more general bullet point later that had a different reference. But the applicants here disclosed very clearly in the 401 application that the intention was to start grading in November 2013, and it was going to carry forward into December 2016. Now, this is for all 200 acres. This involves the Northwest, the Northeast, and the South. But we should understand that this is actually the intention at that time. This is what was disclosed at that time. But there's more, but because if we look at the schedule that's provided, and I think, Kendall, if you can, I'm not sure if we have that schedule. There's another page of that 401 certification application that provides, well, we'll just stop with that. I think that's the only slide there. Now, let's take it to what happened next. The next thing that occurred is the 401 certification occurred, and that's Exhibit 335. And then we keep moving. You saw the Sun Ranch Notice of Intent. This is October 2nd, 2014. This was shown to Mr. Bone, and there's no dispute. We don't need to show this document again. There's no dispute that Sun Ranch, submitted this Notice of Intent back in this time frame. So let's keep moving forward, and we get to this June 2015 time frame. June 2015, that's the time frame when construction activities really start to, get going soon after that. And we heard from Mr. Beislein in his testimony. Mr. Beislein was the contract, well, his company, Tom Beislein Construction, was the person who was hired, or his company was hired, to do perimeter BMP control. So let's look at Defense Exhibit 12. We haven't spent a lot of time on this, but this is the initial contract. It's dated June 16, 2015. And again, it's between Sunrise Pacific Construction and Beislein Construction. And this contract, if we go down to page 11, well, let's scroll back up, because we just saw the prior page. You heard Ms. Macedo talk about the fact that the budget was not enough. And granted, this was a $50,000 contract, but understand this contract was to be built on time and materials. This was just the starting point. It was the initial starting point for Mr. Beislein's work. It was an opportunity for him to bill against the $50,000 starting point, and then bill later through change orders. And we'll show you that's what happened. So there wasn't a limitation on BMP budgeting at the beginning. It was a typical process that was pursued here. Now let's go to the next page, because this is important. Mr. Beislein's company had a detailed and very involved scope of work. It was provided by the contract. And I don't think you've seen this before, but this is Exhibit B to the first Beislein contract. And it provided all of the details about what the specific requirements were that Mr. Beislein's company would agree to undertake. And you heard Mr. Beislein testify that he received all the support he needed from the construction team of the general contractor to perform his work. He believed they were diligent. He believed they cared about stormwater compliance issues. He also did testify that he viewed Varner, the grading contractor, as a problem. So let's keep moving, because we'd heard from other people during deposition testimony that you didn't hear from here. And one of them is Mr. Meyer. So we'll look at Mr. Meyer's testimony. Peter Meyer is one of the city representatives. You didn't hear from Mr. Meyer in this hearing. The prosecution team didn't present his testimony, and we didn't have time to present him live, but we have a lot of deposition testimony from Mr. Meyer, and you should read it. He's one of the City of Lake Forest representatives that testified here, and he made clear that he viewed Mr. Beislein and his company as a competent BMP contractor. So we wanted to point out that, in case you were questioning Mr. Beislein's competence or whether Sunrise Pacific Construction hired the right people, the city thought so. The city actually testified under oath to this. So let's keep moving. I have a lot to get through. We'll move to Defense Exhibit 7. This is the grading permit. We don't really need to show this, but this is a grading permit that was issued in June 22nd, 2015. Well, we can go back, Kendall. June 22nd, 2015. I want to show one thing, and that's in the lower left-hand corner, folks, ladies and gentlemen. This shows that the city approved the SWIP, okay? That's as part of the rough grading plans. The SWIP was approved, reviewed and approved by the city. That's important, and I'll come back to it here shortly. When we're going to go back to some more city testimony about this topic, because you heard just a moment ago from Ms. Macedo that, well, grading wasn't supposed to happen at the rainy season. Well, let's look at what the City of Lake Forest said about that, because the City of Lake Forest makes clear that the city's grading permit allowed the project to move forward during the grading season. That's consistent with the project schedule, the specific project schedule that was provided in the application for a 401 certification that I just showed you. And we see his testimony. I want to show it for a minute. We're looking at pages 13 and 14 of his testimony. And he specifically says he understood that the city would allow grading operations during the rainy season. That was permitted by the city. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, the city was at the site every single day. Mr. John De La Cruz, who I'm going to show you testimony from repeatedly, he was the city inspector that was assigned to this project site. Remarkably, you know, the prosecution team doesn't present Mr. De La Cruz and doesn't present any of his testimony. It's important testimony for you to review, so I'm going to show you some of that. The other point here made by Mr. Meyer, the city representative who testified here in deposition on pages 13 and 14, is that the grading operations were allowed to proceed on the whole project at one time. The city knew that that's what was planned, and the city expressly permitted that to occur. So any argument or suggestion that grading was only supposed to happen on little pieces of the project, well, that's inconsistent with what was permitted on this project. Let's keep moving. We have a lot to get through, and I'll move to Exhibit 326. Now we're in July of 2015. This is right before construction activities are set to begin. This is SWIP Amendment 2, and this is the SWIP Amendment that was in effect at the time construction started. If we scroll down to the bottom of the page, I just want to note that, again, we're looking at a SWIP Amendment that's approved by the city that allows for construction to start December 1st, 2014. Our clients aren't going rogue and doing grading operations when they're not allowed to. This is a permitted activity. It was fully disclosed, and it was disclosed here again. The SWIP amendment also provides for what's called an engineer's schedule, and I want to point that out to you. If we look at page 31 of 31, the last page of this SWIP amendment, now, this isn't the construction schedule. We're looking at page 31 of Exhibit 326. This is not the construction schedule that was used for construction, but it's important to point out that the engineers, this is the same engineer that prepared the grading plans. They know how much volume of dirt's going to be moved. They know how complex this site is. Well, they prepared their schedule, and they showed grading operations would occur between July 21st and December 2015. Again, in the rainy season, at least partially. But more importantly than that, look at the time period. It's a fairly short window. It's a shorter window than Mr. Bone testified to. It's August, September, October, November. 4+ months is what the engineer projected grading activities would take to get accomplished. Now, Mr. Bone testified, and he showed you the actual construction schedule for the site. The construction team for the general contractor, he didn't rely on this. They expanded the schedule. And this notion that there was a rushed or accelerated schedule, it's just not supported by any evidence. The prosecution team said that repeatedly during their presentation, and what they didn't share with the board was a schedule. They didn't show one, and the reason is because none of the documents actually support that suggestion. So I wanted to make sure we showed this document as well. It's important. Now we move on. We heard about Varner and its contract. This is an important one, and we'll pull it up briefly. Defense Exhibit 9. Varner Construction was hired, again, in that same time frame, July 2015, to conduct the mass grading activities. And boy, I mean, Ms. Macedo made a big deal of the fact that the budget in the contract for erosion control was what I think around $40,000. What again, this demonstrates a complete lack of understanding of how these contracts work. This is a $6 million contract. It is the single largest contract on this project, and it encompasses much more than a single line item that she's pointing to. The grading operations, the mass grading activities that are included in that $6 million specifically include building these pond and burned areas on the project site that we'll talk about more, that Mr. Walker testified to, that Mr. Elder acknowledged exists. That's part of this $6 million budget. Trying to parse out and show that a $39,000 line item is somehow representative of what was budgeted and paid for work on this site relating to that work, it's just not accurate. So I wanna keep moving and quickly touch on Prosecution Team Exhibit 178. This is another thing. I don't know that this has been before the board, but this is the change of information that was submitted. Well, this is the summary from the prosecution team. I'm sorry, but it does show that on July 27, 2015, and this is when grading starts, the COI was submitted, increasing the scope of the construction activities to 95.1 acres. And that's what ultimately was started in July of 2015. So we can go back to our timeline and the next slide, slide three, July 2015, right after that last slide, that's when grading starts. The evidence is all consistent with this. The next item on our timeline is July 29, 2015. So right at the same time that grading activities start, you heard Mr. Bone testify that the property was transferred from Sun Ranch to this single purpose entity, SRCPH. And he explained why. It's typical. It's the same thing, by the way, that Mr. Frame testified that Land C did. Land C transferred various parts of the property to other single purpose entities. Well, that's what happened here. And then soon after, we'll get to the later transfer to Land C. So from this point on, July 29, 2015, up until November 12, 2015, SRCPH is the owner of the property. And we acknowledge and certainly aren't hiding from the fact that SRCPH is a wholly owned subsidiary by Sun Ranch. So Sun Ranch is still involved. In this case, it's the parent of SRCPH. So we get to this next critical point, which is mid-September 2015. Grading operations are in their early stages at this point in time. And we have our first rain event, September 15, 2015. That is the first rain event. We've heard about the first discharge event, September 15. This is it. What happened in that time frame is important, and it's not been clearly represented to this board to this point. So I'm going to start with what happened directly before the September 15 rainfall event. And specifically, we'll click on Exhibit 229, which is a copy of this is a rain event action plan dated September 14th. This is something that was required on this project because it's a risk level 2 project. Mr. Cameron Mann, the project QSP, the one that Mr. Beislein complimented as being diligent and intelligent, he prepared these documents and he prepared one as required for this storm event. We'll keep moving because there's much more. Click on the next item. This is Exhibit 92, page 39 and 40. Now this is Mr. De La Cruz. I mentioned him before. He prepared these inspection forms routinely, not just before storms. This is a pre-storm inspection, but he did it after storms. And sometimes he prepared these inspection reports just as a matter of routine. In this particular pre-storm event, I want to note something, and that is Mr. De La Cruz, he's the gentleman from the city that was on site every single day watching what was happening. Well, he estimated the percent of disturbed area at that time was 15%, not 60%, not 50%. 15%. That's not my client. That's not a discharger. That's the city representative. So let's keep going because let's see, I want to turn, can we go back to Exhibit 92, page 40, just to the bottom? Okay, we can keep moving. I there was another point. I think it's in his deposition. So we'll move to the next item is Mr. De La Cruz testified under oath in this matter. And the prosecution team didn't show any of that deposition testimony, but there's quite a bit, and I'm going to refer to a bunch of it. Let's go back up to the top. We'll start at his deposition, page 302. So page 303, my apologies. Page 303 of Mr. De La Cruz's deposition. I just showed you Exhibit 92, pages 39 and 40, where Mr. De La Cruz said his inspection report identified 15% of the site had been graded at that time. Well, we don't have to just rely on that inspection report because he gave testimony under oath. And Mr. De La Cruz specifically said that at that time, September 14th, based upon his observations of the site, less than 15% had been disturbed by grading activities. I didn't make him say it. This is what he said. He was the one that was there every day. I want to also go to page 304 of his deposition testimony because he also indicated that the day before that first discharge event on September 14th, he did not identify any concerns or deficiencies relative to erosion control practices on that date. He's the one that inspected the site. Remember, we saw his pre-storm inspection, and he did not identify concerns. So this is just to understand, these inspection reports were delivered by Mr. De La Cruz to the QSP. The QSP works for Sunrise Pacific Construction, and he's seeing inspection reports that indicate the city does not have concerns. This is quite a different story than what the prosecution team presented. Now, if we keep moving, we'll go to September 15th. We know that the first rain event occurred on September 15th. There's absolutely no dispute about that, and we don't need to go into documents about it. That's when the first discharge happened. But let's see what happened right after the September 15th event, because if we heard, the prosecution team would suggest that the September 15th event was devastating, but the testimony from others suggests otherwise. Let's look at Mr. De La Cruz's deposition testimony. He testified at page 178 of his deposition. He said, I asked him, because we had a series of questions, and I said, you just don't recall there being any significant consequences as a result of that September storm. And he answered, not as to the south side. It was mostly the northwest side. This is important. And we'll move on to another piece of deposition testimony relating to this same topic.
I'm sorry, Mr. T. I'm sorry for interrupting. I see that Advisory Council, Lori Oaken has her hand up.
I only see three board members on camera. If Ms. Blair is listening to the audio without the camera, could you let us know that? Otherwise, we'll have to take a break.
Yes, yes, I am. Thank you. Thank you, Megan. Popping off camera. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. T. Please proceed.
Nope, thank you. It gave me a chance to get some water. Trying to get through this. The next item was some more deposition testimony. And this is from Ms. Ryan, again, from the board. And she gave testimony on this topic too. I want to point this out, and I quoted it here because she indicated that her general understanding is that the September 15 was from the northwest, and she's referring to the discharge, and that was documented by the Region 8 report. By Region 8 in their report. And then she noted that the later storms were from the south. So to be clear, the import of all this is the import of Mr. De La Cruz's testimony and Ms. Ryan's testimony about that September 15th primarily being a discharge from the northwest relates to what Mr. Melbourne showed you, because he showed you some images and video that suggest that there was this massive discharge from the Portola South on September 15th. And what we're actually seeing is run on from the Portola Northwest site. That's what it was. And Mr. Elder's report, if everybody looks at page 6 of his report, he specifically reported that he did not calculate run-on from the northwest site. Neither did Mr. Walker, neither one of them, because that's outside of the scope of what was presented. Now, let's keep going, and we'll move to September 21st, 2015.
Excuse me, Mr. T, I have another hand up. I don't know what this is regarding, but please let's allow Board Member Olson to speak. I apologize.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to have to step away for 2 minutes. I apologize. My husband is ill and he called me from downstairs. So 2 minutes, I apologize.
Let's take a 5-minute break.
I apologize.
And so each side will both have 5-minute breaks.
Thank you.
To catch your breath. And to accommodate our board. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will reconvene at 11:52. It is now 10:52, time to reconvene. Welcome back from a 5-minute break.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I continue?
Please do.
Thank you. We'll put our presentation back on, and we were at the September 21st timeframe and looking specifically at what has been presented in the record as Defense Exhibit 13. And this is the first in a series of change orders in which Beislein, Mr. Beislein's company, I'm calling
Excuse it Beislein. Excuse me, Mr. T. Can we ask the board members either to turn their cameras on or just to state that they're there?
Ms. Blair, are you there?
Yes, just trying to unmute. I'm here.
Thank you. And Mr. Anderson, are you there? Perhaps she has not yet returned. We have a 1, 2, 3, 4. We have a quorum. Thank you. I apologize, Mr. T.
Not a problem. We'll carry on. So we're looking at now Defense Exhibit 13, which is Beislein's first change order. And you heard Mr. Beislein testify on Monday that every time he requested authorization to conduct additional BMP work and to increase his scope of payment, he was given that authority. He was never denied. He was always allowed to do the work he believed was needed. And this is the first in a series of change orders in which Mr. Beislein was authorized to do BMP work for yet another $100,000. This is the type of evidence, and we'll show more of it. It's evidence that is not reflective of a project contractor or land developer who chooses profit over water quality at every opportunity, as argued by the prosecution team. I'd like to continue forward a little bit in time to October, and specifically to October 6th. And we have this entry relating to the first notes of concern regarding leaking equipment. And we'll look at some deposition testimony on this topic. Mr. De La Cruz, again, the city inspector, he confirmed in his deposition testimony that the October 6th inspection report was the first time he ever noted the existence of leaking equipment or oils on site. He testified he regularly inspected for oils and fuel leaks, and he, in his inspection reports, actually have a specific line item where he notes that if he sees it. So his testimony was October 6th was the first time he observed this type of condition. And then we'll turn to another exhibit, prosecution team exhibit 34, that relates to this same topic. This was 3 days later. 3 days later, this first citation was issued. And if we look at the highlighted language, one of the key things that was noted is that equipment drips and leaks and containment at the above ground fuel storage were noted. That was part of this, a key part of this citation. It's obviously a concern regarding water quality issues. So again, did the contractor ignore that and not do anything? Did the contractor choose profit over water quality? Well, no, we're going to show you the evidence doesn't support that. Let's look at the next item. This is just 3 days later. And this is Mr. De La Cruz's testimony, again, from page 332 of his deposition. And Mr. De La Cruz testified that between October 6th and October 12th, the leaking equipment and the soil that had been stained by leaks, it had all been cleaned up. So there had been prompt action in response to the city's citation regarding the leaks. Again, this is evidence that the prosecution team did not show you. This is evidence that shows efforts to clean up. This is evidence that shows evidence to, or efforts to cooperate. It's evidence that shows that the prosecution team's claim that the project general contractor or owner chose profit over water quality in all instances is not supported by the evidence. And there's much more of this type of testimony and evidence. Let's look at John De La Cruz, Mr. De La Cruz's deposition testimony at page 350. During his sworn testimony, I asked Mr. De La Cruz to look at every single one of his inspection reports to confirm whether he had ever noted oil leaks and leaking fluids again on any of his inspection reports. Again, he was there every day. He confirmed that after the October 6th inspection report, the one I just showed you, that he did not note any such evidence through the entire balance of 2015, not once. Again, this is important because it's important evidence that contradicts the arguments presented by the prosecution team that the discharges that occurred, the ones we acknowledge occurred, were comprised of something like toxic soup. I mean, the evidence just doesn't support that. Mr. De La Cruz is the city inspector who was there, and he's reporting that during this period of months, critical months, where the discharges occurred, he did not see these oil leaks and stains, and he was charged with reporting these things. Let's keep moving, and we'll move forward to October 29th, 2015. This is the final entry on this page. Page 3 of the chronology. And this is Varner's change order number 4. Remember, Varner has the grading contract to do $6 million worth of work. And we'll pull this up. Varner requested and was given authorization to do additional work to prepare for rain days. Now we see here that In particular, Varner was authorized to do 300, this is prepare for rain days work per a proposal that Varner provided to the general contractor. And again, we're looking at Defense Exhibit 10. And you'll see that Varner was authorized to do an additional 305 hours of overtime work for September, 812.5 hours for October 2015, and 500 hours for both November and December 2015. This is not the type of evidence that supports the prosecution team claim that the dischargers always chose profit over water quality. In fact, this is the exact opposite. It's the type of evidence that shows that general contractor, the owner, prioritized stormwater management issues and paid a substantial amount in efforts to maintain BMPs on the site and to prepare for rain events. And there's more. Let's keep going. The next item is on the next page. And now we're on page 4 of the presentation. We're moving closer to the final 3 discharge events. I'm not going to show you this document because we just saw it this morning and it should be fresh. But on November 12, 2015, that's when the property was sold to Landsea. And that's when Sunrise Pacific Construction entered into a general contract with Landsea and started working for Landsea. The important thing I want to note here is that we showed the grading schedule. Remember, the grading schedule showed 182 days for clearing, grubbing, and rough grading. And again, you heard testimony from the prosecution team time and time again on Monday suggesting there was some type of accelerated or rushed or unreasonable grading schedule. What the prosecution team never showed you during their presentation, they never showed you a construction schedule. They just said it was rushed. They just said it was accelerated. We actually showed it to you and we explained how it was developed and the fact that it wasn't accelerated at all. Now, moving to November. Again, November 12, 2015, I don't need to dwell on this point. The property was conveyed and sold to Landsea. That's been well established. Let's move into December. Now we're in the critical time frame because remember, 3 of the 4 discharge events occurred between late December and early January. So this is really the critical time frame for the discharge events, at least. And we look at December 18, 2015. And Defense Exhibit 14. And we'll show that document. We just saw another instance where Mr. Beislein's company was authorized to do additional work, where here we have it again. This is just before the 3 of the 4 storm events that resulted in discharges, that we acknowledge resulted in discharges. And when Mr. Beislein asked to have additional scope and payment for BMP work, it was authorized. He was allowed and permitted to do exactly what he asked for. So again, further evidence contradicting this profit over water quality concept. Let's keep moving. That same day on December 18th, there is another exhibit that I want to show you. It's exhibit 229, pages 18 through 23. Now this is a rain event action plan that was issued by the project QSP on December 18th, 4 days before the predicted storm event of December 22nd. December 22nd is when, well, there was predicted rain on 12/18, but there was also predicted rain on 12/22, and that's the storm event that actually resulted in discharge. This is the second storm event that resulted in discharge. So let's move to 12/22. Okay, we know that there was a rain event because we know there was a discharge. So what happened after that? What documentation is there about what occurred on the 12/22 event? Well, we have Mr. De La Cruz, again, performing a post-storm inspection on 12/28. And he noted in his post-storm inspection, no discharges of oil, toxic, or hazardous. On the next page, he noted no toxics, hazardous materials, or anything of that sort on that final entry. Consistent with his testimony earlier that from October all the way through December, he never noted indications of oil spills, fluids from the equipment being on the soil. Let's keep moving to 12/31. This is the week before. We are about a week before the 2 final rain events and discharge events, the ones that resulted in the most discharge from this site under any scenario. And Exhibit 229, page 16, we'll pull that up. This is an email from the Project QSP to Varner. And again, the Project QSP is instructing Varner to ensure that necessary earth perms are built before the rain that's forecasted for the following week. Now, what he's talking about here, these are the same sediment traps or ponds that Mr. Walker showed you photo after photo of. They're all over the site. Ms. Macedo earlier in the day disparagingly called these things tire tracks from equipment. Well, that's not right. It's not even consistent with the testimony of Mr. Elder. Mr. Elder acknowledged that the CASCA BMP handbook specifically provides for something called sediment traps. They're not engineered. They don't need to be engineered. They're a recognized BMP just for this situation to collect stormwater. Well, that's what the QSP was telling the construction team to do. And as we saw yesterday, Mr. Walker walked through photo after photo of sediment traps that were actually present on the site in this exact time frame. We're not talking about tire tracks. We're talking about intentional features that were developed to capture and hold the rainwater, stormwater, and sediment on site. So let's keep moving and we'll look at Exhibit 83. Again, Exhibit 229 referred to an attachment. Well, this is the attachment. It's three pages. And again, you've never seen these before because the prosecution team didn't show it to you, but these are BMP maps. These are, you know, construction and a grading project evolves. It's a very dynamic situation. It evolves over time very quickly. And these BMP maps are updated regularly. Mr. Mann, the Project QSP, was charged with maintaining and communicating this information to the grading contractor in particular, and also to Beislein, who did the other BMP work. And this shows the same features that Mr. Walker showed you. There's a series of red lines all over this that are bermed sediment traps. They're permitted BMPs per the CASCA manual. Now, Mr. Melbourne criticized the project for not having engineered basins. Well, just to be clear, not all sediment traps are not engineered basins. They don't have to be, but they're still a recognized BMP. In fact, Mr. Elder acknowledged that. He said it. I asked him about it yesterday, and he said sediment traps are not engineered, and they are recognized by the CASCA handbook. So let's keep going. January 4th, this is right before the last two of the 4 days of rain and discharge. We have another inspection report. Mr. De La Cruz, the city inspector, did a pre-storm inspection. And what does he note? Let's read it. I want to look at his language. At the bottom of his report, he keeps notes. And he says, this is Mr. De La Cruz in his notes, BMPs were upgraded and maintenance along the perimeter of the site in preparation for forecasted rain events. So again, this is the city inspector, and you didn't see this information because the prosecution team just didn't show it to you. But this shows that there was an active effort by the general contractor and their construction team to prepare for and manage stormwater for the anticipated rain events. They weren't asleep at the wheel. They were doing what they thought needed to be done. And we're not saying they did it all right. We've acknowledged that there were violations, but they were making their best efforts. That's what the team was doing. And that's what Mr. De La Cruz noted here. And he said more. So let's keep going. If we look at Mr. De La Cruz's testimony from the same time frame, about this same time frame, I asked him about his testimony right before those last two I asked him questions during his deposition testimony about what he observed in that period right before those final two rain events. And he testified that he did not observe any signs of spills or fluids, vehicle fluids or oils in his pre-storm inspection. That's what he said. Again, contradicting the prosecution team's unfounded argument that there was some type of toxic soup that was discharged in those January discharge events. Let's move to page 353 because there's more. Like he noted, Mr. De La Cruz had noted in his inspection report that I just showed you, he noted there was progress and effort made to upgrade and maintain perimeter controls in preparation for that early January storm. Again, those were BMP efforts that were directed by the general contractor, Sunrise Pacific Construction, and performed by the construction team. So we move on. A couple days later, January 5th, January 6th, we know what happened. There were pretty significant rain events on the project site. And we know that there were discharges from the project site. It's not disputed. And we do question the volume, and we'll get to that more, but we know there was rain. So what we'll get to next is what occurred next. And what we see, I'm going to just quickly visit Prosecution Team Exhibit 92, page 9. This is another inspection report from Mr. De La Cruz from January 7th, 2016. It's his post-storm inspection report. Okay, and this is what Mr. De La Cruz noted visiting the site the day after the final of the four rain events. He noted that Biceline was on site and HRS, another contractor, was on site repairing, installing, maintaining BMPs. Let's look at Mr. De La Cruz's testimony on this topic. We'll look at his testimony at page 139. And he describes exactly what he observed during that period of time immediately following the January storm events. He testified that both Biceline and Varner were actively working on the site, trying to correct BMPs, upgrade BMPs, build berms. This is cleanup and cooperation. This is active efforts directed by the general contractor to remedy the conditions that had occurred in January. And again, this isn't to suggest that the January discharge didn't occur. It did. But the construction team was actively working on correcting the conditions. And the city inspector noted this in his reports, and he testified to it under oath in his deposition. So let's keep going down our timeline, and we'll go to February 19th. We know that the regional board first visited the site in January. We know that there was a stop work order in January 21st. And we've heard about the notice of default. This morning, there was some questioning about the default, Varner's default. I think, Madam Chair, you might have mentioned this. And we'll look at Defense Exhibit 24 for a minute, just to visit that. January 21st, 2016, there's a letter that goes to Mr. Varner, and this is a notice of default. Again, Mr. Varner has a $6 million contract, and there's a process to follow to terminate this contract. Granted, the project general contractor was not pleased with Varner Construction's performance. As Mr. Biceline explained, Varner Construction was very difficult. Varner Construction often did what it wanted to do without regard to what the directions were from the general contractor. But it's no easy task terminating a subcontractor with a $6 million contract, and there had to be a process. So this is the start of that process. This is a notice of termination letter sent just a couple of weeks after that final discharge event, January and early January. And we'll keep going. It's worth noting and pointing out that the general superintendent, somebody we haven't heard a lot about, which is Mr. Giedemann, he was also terminated. He was viewed as not having properly managed the BMPs in the site, and he was replaced with somebody else named Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark is somebody you heard about from Mr. Biceline. Mr. Clark was replaced Mr. Giedemann, and the intention was to put a more responsive general superintendent in place. Again, these are efforts to try to make sure that things are done right. We get to February 9, 2016. And once again, Defense Exhibit 16 will show that. February 9, 2016, and Tom Biceline Construction has yet more change order work. This is a change order on another contract, adding yet another $100,000 of scope to do BMP work on the site. Finally, Varner's termination is just about complete, and the general contractor hires a new grading contractor, LB3, to take over grading operations and the scope of work performed by Varner. Another effort to try to improve the site management and improve the BMPs on the site. Let's keep moving. Finally, Defense Exhibit 25. After the requisite contractual process was undertaken, the right to cure period passed, Varner's contract is officially terminated in March. And then I'm not going to show you all these documents here because I'm going to show you some of them later, but there are a series of additional contracts entered with yet another BMP contractor called SoCal Sandbags. whereby Sunrise Pacific Construction agreed to have yet more BMP work done on this site. And then the timeline ends here on August 12, 2016, just because that is the time frame when Landsea took over as general contractor and Sunrise Pacific Construction is no longer the general contractor for the project. So we can move off of the chronology. I just wanted to provide the benefit of some of the evidence that has not been shown. There's an abundance of evidence from Mr. De La Cruz in particular, his testimony, his inspection reports, and I encourage the board to look at all of it. I can't go through all of it today, so I tried to highlight some of the what I view as the important evidence. I want to return to something I talked about Monday. When I did my opening comments, I talked about really two overarching issues. We acknowledged there were violations on the site. We acknowledged there were discharges on the site. The real questions are two, and I talked about these earlier, and that's what is the appropriate volume estimate for the 4 days of discharge? You know, an accurate and a reliable one. What is the appropriate enforcement policy scoring? Well, it's one that's based upon the evidence, and there's much evidence that you haven't been presented with. So I want to spend most of the rest of my time on these two topics, and I'll start with slide eight. Slide eight. Now, we know Mr. Elder used the NRCS method to calculate his volume estimate of 6.3 million gallons. He readily admitted to using that. This is slide eight shows Defense Exhibit 28, pages 2 through 11. This is the actual TR-55, Technical Release 55, that explains the NRCS method. And we highlighted a couple parts. These were highlighted by Dr. Hermonka. The TR-55 makes clear the NRCS method lacks accuracy when used to calculate stormwater runoff or runoff from an actual storm. That's not what it was ever intended to do. It was intended for design. But that's exactly what Mr. Elder did here. So let's turn to the next slide. Why did Mr. Elder use an inappropriate method? Well, I would propose it's lack of experience in hydrologic modeling. He testified under oath that he had never before used the NRCS method to perform hydrologic studies. And he also testified under oath that he had never used the SWIM model either. We've shown his testimony on those topics on slide 9. He testified to this under oath in volume 1 at pages 113 and 114. Let's move to the next slide. Mr. Elder also testified in his under oath in his deposition that this case was the very first time he had used the NRCS method to calculate runoff from a construction site, first time. In short, I mean, Mr. Elder just lacks the experience necessary and the expertise necessary to provide expert analysis and testimony on hydrologic modeling. His own testimony makes that crystal clear. You don't have to rely on Dr. Hermonka for it. You can rely on the words from Mr. Elder that he gave under oath. Let's move to slide 10. Now, you heard Dr. Hermonka testify at length based upon his testimony. I'm sorry, based upon his 50 years of experience, that Mr. Elder's runoff. That Mr. Elder's runoff estimate lacked any measure of reliability and accuracy. But you don't have to rely on Dr. Hermonka's testimony because we have Mr. Elder's testimony to make that clear. So let's go to the slide with Mr. Elder's testimony. And I asked Mr. Elder specifically about the accuracy of his volume estimate using the NRCS method. And this is what he said. I said, so you cannot say how accurate the model output that you generated is. And he said, no. And I asked, could it be 50% off the actual discharge volumes? He said, I don't know. I asked, could it be 70% off the actual discharge volumes? He answered under oath, I don't know. Mr. Elder cannot give any reasonable measure of certainty about the accuracy of his 6.3 million gallon runoff estimate. He doesn't know how accurate it is. And as Dr. Hermonka said, and we'll get into it, it's not, because the NRCS method necessarily overstates runoff volumes because it's a design tool. For this reason, the 6.3 million gallon estimate provided by Mr. Helder, it just cannot be used as a basis for volume penalties. It can't. And I'll just note that it seems the prosecution team is starting to recognize this because there was reference to yet a third calculation done by Tommy Sue, somebody who's not even an engineer, who used the same NRCS model or method to calculate an even more inaccurate volume estimate. One that if looked at for just a brief few moments, one can see includes all kinds of incorrect assumptions. And it doesn't bear any measure of reliability either for the same reasons that Dr. Hromadka testified to. And I'll get to Dr. Hromadka's findings next with slide 11. Dr. Hromadka, to put it short and simply, he made clear that Mr. Helder should not have used the NRCS method for this purpose. He made clear that Mr. Helder misapplied the method in a number of ways that resulted in further exaggeration of his runoff estimate. And it doesn't matter if Mr. Helder did this on purpose or if he did it because of lack of experience. The bottom line is, using the NRCS method to calculate runoff, it necessarily overestimates runoff. And then he clearly applied assumptions that resulted in yet more overestimation of runoff. So let's get to what is the reasonable hydrologic calculation or estimate for runoff from the site. Well, you heard about it yesterday. So let's turn to slide 12. What we've shown here, and we heard from Mr. Walker yesterday, we've shown his report. It's Defense Exhibit 5. And Defense Exhibit 5 is the Torrey Walker Engineering Report where he summarized his findings and explained his findings. But he did more than that. This is part of the record, but he did more. He provided all of his SWIM modeling materials. There's thousands of pages of documentation that were submitted in the record. And that's because we wanted to make sure that Mr. Walker showed his work. He did. He showed his work. And ultimately, Mr. Walker, he estimated that 1.94 million gallons of discharge is the most appropriate estimate to be used for the four discharge events. In fact, he made clear that he believes the 1.94 million gallon figure is yet still an overestimate of actual runoff because he used conservative assumptions in his calculations. As a result, we would present again that this is the only reasonable basis for that can be used in this particular matter for as a basis for the assessment of volume penalties for violation number one. Now I want to move to the second issue. And this is the enforcement policy scoring issue. I want to spend a few minutes on the enforcement policy scoring and the related evidence. So let's go to slide 14. We heard a lot about potential for harm yesterday from Ms. Dr. Thatcher. He showed you this language. This is the language on slide 14, I believe, that is taken directly from the enforcement policy. This is the text of the enforcement policy. Note the prosecution team didn't show you this text, but Dr. Thatcher took you through it, and he took you through the particular language of this factor. Now, down in the bottom of the same slide, we see the reference to the number four. Well, that's the figure, no, score of four is what the prosecution team has proposed should be applied for this particular factor. As Dr. Thatcher indicated, the evidence doesn't support this score. So let's keep moving, slide 15. Now, Mr. Melbourne testified about this factor on Monday. He is the prosecution team staff member who prepared this score, the score of four for the potential for harm factor, and he's the one who testified about it. He's a lawyer and he's a civil engineer, but he's not an expert regarding assessment of impacts on stormwater discharges. Ms. Clement, in her testimony, acknowledged that fact in deposition and ultimately at the hearing. She acknowledged that the prosecution team doesn't have any experts qualified on these topics. And there was no testimony, really expert testimony, about the analysis of potential harm. Instead, we heard colloquialisms like toxic soup. Let's keep going, slide 16. Now here, this is Mr. Meldorn's testimony where he explained he assigned a score of four because it's his opinion, the opinion of a lawyer and a civil engineer, but not an expert on the assessment of stormwater discharges on beneficial uses. Again, this is Mr. Meldorn's deposition testimony, pages 42 and 43. Let's move to slide 17. Now what I've shown on the left-hand side of this slide is the first page of Defense Exhibit 1. This is the RINCON ACLC technical report. This is a document that addresses all of Dr. Thatcher's opinions. It also addresses Mr. Snyder's opinions. And it's a long report. It's very detailed. It cites to all of the evidence that they've referred to. And it also has voluminous appendices. Again, Rincon showed its work. All of that evidence is before this board and should be considered. In response to the prosecution team's proposed score for the potential harm for beneficial uses, you heard Dr. Thatcher testify that he undertook a rigorous assessment of the available evidence regarding this scoring factor, and he ultimately concluded that the prosecution team's proposed score was unsupported. Now, because his testimony was an overview, again, I encourage the board look at, please, Defense Exhibit 1. If there's more details that need to be known, this report is a very detailed report with a number of appendices and backup material. I want to keep moving and look at the next scoring factor, which is toxicity. Again, this is step one, factor two in the scoring for alleged violation number one. This is the language we're showing you on this slide 18. This is the language from the enforcement policy. This is language the prosecution team didn't show you. Here on the bottom, we highlighted the score of two because that's the score the prosecution team has proposed for this particular factor. The evidence doesn't support this score. Let's go to slide 19, please. Again, Mr. Melbourne is the prosecution team staff member who prepared this score for the toxicity factor, and he testified about it. But notably, Mr. Melbourne also gave deposition testimony on this topic. And we put that on the screen, pages 90, 92, and 93 of his deposition. And he had admitted under oath that he does not have expertise in the assessment of the degree of toxicity of stormwater discharges. And yet, he's the prosecution team member that assessed this very factor. In short, the prosecution team's proposed score is not based on expert analysis. Slide 20, please. The culpability factor. We've heard a fair amount about this, and yesterday we heard a lot of testimony from Mr. Snyder about this particular adjustment factor that comes from the enforcement policy. This is the language we're showing on this particular slide. This is the language from the enforcement policy, Table 4, that shows the criteria that are to be used for scoring the culpability factor. And as you see here, there's a range of scores that can be applied from 0.5 to 1.5. So a high score, like a 1.5, that score results in a substantial multiplier on the penalty amount, significantly increasing the penalty amount. A score of lower than one actually results in a reduction in the penalty amount. Now here, the prosecution team argued that the proposed score for culpability should be 1.3. That adds a 30% multiplier on top of the penalty amount in the penalty calculation methodology. Now, what was the basis for this score of 1.3 that was presented by the prosecution team? Well, this testimony largely came from Mr. Melbourne, and some of it came from Ms. Clement. And in general, what you heard was that the prosecution team said the dischargers deserve a higher culpability score, a 1.3, as opposed to a lawyer's lower score, because the dischargers accelerated grading. They did accelerated grading in their quest for profits at the expense of water quality. But what evidence did they provide? If you think back, they provided none. The prosecution team didn't show you the construction schedule. They didn't show you the testimony of the city inspector and Mr. Meyer discussing all the efforts and related efforts to conduct BMP work. They didn't mention Mr. Beislein's testimony that he believed the general contractor's construction team gave him all the resources he needed to perform BMP work. And instead, Mr. Melbourne, in his presentation, showed you 25 photographs. 25, that's it. We counted them up. The whole presentation consisted of 25 photos. There are over 2,500 photographs available on this in this record, and you saw 25 of them. Now, we know, and I acknowledge that my very first comment this morning was, we know there were BMP problems on the site. We've admitted that. We've acknowledged it, and Mr. Snyder made clear yesterday that in large part, as to the non-discharge violations 2 through 8, we've acknowledged that those violations actually occurred on many of the same days that Mr. Melbourne identified. However, the evidence makes clear, despite the violations, that the general contractor had a team that prioritized and attempted to manage BMP work the best it could. It hired subcontractors who had specialty in this particular topic. The general contractor hired Biceline, somebody who had 35 years of experience in BMP work to conduct BMPs on site. The subcontractors were given the resources they needed to do that work. Mr. Biceline confirmed that under oath in this hearing. And consistent with the testimony of the city inspector and the photographic evidence that Mr. Snyder showed you, there were BMPs on the site, all over the site. You wouldn't know that after listening to Mr. Melbourne's presentation. He showed you 25 photographs that would lead you to believe there were no BMPs. That's simply not true. There were violations. There were instances of inadequate BMPs, but there were BMPs on this site. I want to talk about this scoring language. It requires an analysis of three things: performance standards, industry standards, and the reasonable prudent person standard. Mr. Melbourne didn't sufficiently describe any of these. Let's get to the next slide. This is his testimony. He testified in deposition that he had no expert opinions regarding any of these topics. And by that, I mean performance standards, industry standards, and the reasonable prudent person standard. These are all criteria that have to be considered and evaluated in looking at the enforcement policy methodology and criteria. And yet he specifically said in sworn testimony that he didn't do an expert analysis of those topics. Now, this completely undermines the prosecution team's proposed scoring on this particular factor. And we'll go to slide 23. This shows further testimony from Mr. Melbourne, pages 15, 19, and 18. And there's a reason why Mr. Melbourne didn't do an expert analysis of performance standards, industry standards, the reasonable prudent person standard. It's because he's not positioned to do that. He testified under oath he's neither a QSP nor a QSD. And he made very clear he doesn't have any experience actually working on construction with a general contractor or other type of contractor. He lacked the experience to do the necessary analysis, and that's why he didn't do it. And that's why we didn't hear Mr. Melbourne walk through a clear articulation of how the evidence, when looked at in through the lens of the enforcement policy language on culpability, justifies a score of 1.3. It doesn't. So let's move on, because slide 23, we heard in contrast with let's move to the next slide. Because in contrast with Mr. Melbourne, on slide 24, we have Mr. Snyder. And we heard from Mr. Snyder yesterday, so I don't want to go into length repeating what he said. But again, Mr. Snyder of Rincon, he testified he is a QSD, he is a QSP, and he is a geologist. And more importantly than all that, what he does for a living isn't testify. He's not a professional witness. He works on construction projects, large-scale grading projects, mostly for public agencies. And what he does on those sites is he manages stormwater BMPs. This is what he does for a living. That's why we hired him, not because he's a hired gun expert. It's because he actually does this for a living. And he applied his expertise to consider and analyze the culpability factor language that is in the enforcement policy. He looked at performance standards, he looked at industry standards, and he evaluated the reasonable prudent person standard based upon all of his own experience, the depth of experience he has in his role as a QSD, QSP, and managing these exact types of projects. And he concluded that the score of 1.3 was not warranted based on the evidence as he described it at length yesterday. And that this, for most of the violations, that score should be reduced to 1.1. Now, it's important to note, 1.1 is not a free pass. It indicates there were errors on the site, and it indicates that the penalty amount should be increased by 10%. Okay, and so he also importantly acknowledged that some of the violations should remain at the 1.3. Same score the prosecution team provided. So we ask you to consider that carefully, given that Mr. Snyder is the one who actually applied a rigorous analysis in accordance with the actual language of the enforcement policy. His analysis should be considered to lower those culpability scores. But I want you to consider more than just that. Let's move to slide 26. Because in addition to what Mr. Snyder pointed out, and Mr. Snyder did a photo by photo analysis of all 2,500 plus photographs, as he described yesterday, as outlined in his report, there's so much more. And in the broad terms, we need to consider the testimony from Mr. Beislein regarding how the Project QSP was a capable, diligent, and intelligent QSP, how the general contractor's construction managers were diligent regarding stormwater management, and the many contracts that show that specialty BMP contractors were hired and paid to perform BMP work on the site.
Mr. T, excuse me for interrupting. We have an announcement from our clerk.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. T, you are just under 15 minutes.
Thank you. I'll pick up the pace. I appreciate that. Okay, so quickly, we'll scroll through this page of the slideshow here, 27, just again, shows various exhibits. The next page, 28, shows various contracts. I'm sorry, let's move one more. Defense exhibits 18 through 20 are here. These are SoCal Sandbags contracts. And you'll see these contracts are for hundreds of thousands of dollars in BMP work. These are all in evidence. I'm not going to dwell on them due to the limited time I have left. But so let's keep moving. Next slide. More SoCal Sandbags contracts. Defendants exhibits 21 and 22. The deviation from requirement factor we'll quickly touch on. And if we look at this slide, shows the actual deviation from requirement language, minor, moderate, major. These are the three categories that can be applied to this particular factor. And in this case, we know that Mr. Melbourne testified that major, the worst possible score should be applied for all violations. Now, this has, a dramatic impact on the penalty amount. Let's keep going. What we didn't hear from Mr. Melbourne was any clear rationale for why major should be applied. In contrast, briefly, Mr. Snyder, again, he performed a very detailed analysis that's included in his Defense Exhibit 1, his expert report, and it was discussed at length yesterday. And after all of Mr. Snyder's analysis, as he discussed it yesterday, he concluded that for most of the violations, and it's noted here, most of the violations should be scored a moderate, the mid-level score. And yet he also agreed that in some instances, the score should be remain as a major. Let's keep moving. Cleanup and cooperation. This is the final factor I'm going to talk about. Maybe grateful for that. This is the final scoring factor that was considered. And on the left-hand side of this slide, we see an actual image that shows Mr. Melbourne's presentation on this topic. It's slide 66 from Mr. Melbourne's presentation on Monday. And highlighted, you see that Mr. Melbourne scored the early violations as a 1.1. And then after October 2015, he scored all violations as a 1.3. That's what he said in his sworn testimony on Monday, 1.3 for all violations after the city notice of violation, which would have been October 2015. I just want to point out here that that is entirely inconsistent with what was presented in the ACL, proposed ACL order presented by the prosecution team. They identified a score of 1.5 for all of those violations. If you look through the ACL order, you'll see that every single violation after October 2015 is scored the highest possible score of 1.5, in contrast to Mr. Melbourne's sworn testimony, where he said the score should be 1.3. I can't overstate the importance of this, because if you do the math, this is $1.5 million difference in the ultimate penalty amount. In other words, if you adopt the testimony of Mr. Melbourne on Monday and his proposed score of 1.3 that he gave in his sworn testimony, the proposed penalty automatically diminishes by about $1.5 million. And I haven't run the penalty calculator, but you can quickly do the math, because it's a 0.2 difference that would be a multiplier. So please take this into consideration. We need to keep moving. And before we move off cleanup and cooperation, I just want to make a couple final notes. And again, I walked through that chronology earlier in my presentation to make the point that there was a significant, sustained, and regular effort to clean up, starting all the way back in the beginning of the project. In October, when the city noted oil leaks, they were immediately cleaned up. We saw when there was a January discharge event, what did the city inspector note? Immediate response, immediate efforts to clean up. The general contractor, the construction team, again, we're not claiming perfection, but what we can say is there was cleanup efforts. There were regular, sustained cleanup efforts. And yet the prosecution team is trying to put a very high score, either a 1.5 or 1.3, depending on which one you adopt from them. The reality is that we believe a score of 1.1 conforms to the actual evidence. The evidence that we showed you, the evidence they didn't share, especially the deposition testimony from the city inspector. And now, this next slide, this is an excerpt from Defendant's Exhibit 149. This was provided with our briefing. And this shows that what we ultimately did is we plugged in all of the scores provided by Dr. Thatcher, Mr. Snyder, and we put in the 1.94 million gallon volume discharge estimate provided by Mr. Walker. We used the $2 per gallon figure, which is the figure that the enforcement policy provides. Same figure that the prosecution team included in their calculation. And we calculated the penalty amount based upon this spreadsheet. This is the penalty calculator. And what we came up with for alleged violation number one, and Ms. Macedo made a big point of this, is $38,685. Well, that's what the number is when you use the penalty calculator and you put in the appropriate scoring methods. This isn't a number we just made up. This is the penalty scoring calculator that is provided by the board. The remaining pages show all of the calculations for every single one of the remaining violations. So violations 2 through 8, the same process was followed. The scoring from Dr. Thatcher, Mr. Snyder, was put into each one of these alleged violations, and the calculations were run. Let's go to the next slide. This is the end result. And this is a slide I showed you on Monday. This is the summary of the dollar amounts that come out from the penalty calculator. This is the penalty calculation per the board's penalty calculator using the 1.9394 million gallon figure from Mr. Walker, as well as the scoring factor scoring provided by Dr. Thatcher and Mr. Snyder. And the total proposed penalty that we would assert is appropriate in this case is based upon that calculation. It's that simple. It's $549,492. Apparently, Ms. Macedo thinks that's a slap on the wrist. My clients view it otherwise. That's a significant amount of money, especially when coupled with the vast sums of money that the general contractor team spent on BMPs on this project. It was not an inexpensive endeavor, and $550,000 is a significant sum. Next slide. A few more topics I need to cover. First is the fair and consistent policy. Ms. Clement referred to this. Next slide. Ms. Clement said that, in fact, the $9 million penalty was fair and consistent, but we need to look at something. Remember, $7.5 million of this proposed penalty relates to the alleged violation number one, the discharge violation. Region 9 has declined to impose per gallon penalties in every other CGP enforcement case ever, and they've done it for a specific reason. It's well documented, and we've cited to regional board documents to show that. The reasoning has always been the same. The reasoning goes as follows, and I'm reading from the San Altos technical memorandum here. Due to difficulty in accurately determining the volume of unauthorized discharges from the site, civil liability was only calculated on a per day basis for the violation. Time and time again, and we've cited to them in technical analysis documents from the regional board staff, and we've cited Defense Exhibit 53, 55, 56, and 66, the board has always concluded the same thing. It's difficult to accurately determine the volume of unauthorized discharge, and therefore civil liabilities are based on a per day basis only. Now, it's important to note, we're not suggesting that that's what the board should do here. We're not suggesting you should revert back to this old approach and just impose per day penalties. Instead, we calculated a volume penalty based upon a volume estimate that is the most reliable and the only accurate estimate, and that's Mr. Walker's. But as far as fair and consistent, this is not fair and consistent. This is inconsistent. Next slide, please. Further, this fair and consistent policy, when considered in the context of the policy scoring, we see that Region 9, this is the scoring of the potential for harm factor. Region 9 has routinely scored this factor as a 4. Every other region in the state Every other region has stayed. We couldn't, there's not a single case that's been scored a four ever in any region. And we this is all in the record. This is all in our presentation, our briefing, and the exhibits attached to our briefing. We didn't make these numbers up. This is based upon actual regional board documents from throughout the state of California. We looked at every CGP case in the state of California, every one. And this is what we found. We found that region 9 scores high. That's not fair and consistent. Next slide. Now, I have to respond to Ms. Rubin's discussion yesterday. She talked about liability of certain entities and certain people. A couple things to get to here, and then I'm done. First, Sun Ranch and SRCPH, those are parties that should be liable here. There's no dispute. We accept that. However, extending liability to the other entities, I'll address those first. Baldwin & Sons, Inc., Baldwin & Sons, LLC, and Sunrise Pacific Construction, it's not supported by the law. Ms. Rubin yesterday told you all that you could rely on the United States Supreme Court for that. She told you you can impose liability on non-permittees, Baldwin & Sons, Inc., Baldwin & Sons, LLC, and Sunrise Pacific Construction, because the U.S. Supreme Court said so. Well, she's wrong. The only case she cited is this case, U.S. v. Best Foods. It's a CERCLA case. It involves a narrow holding regarding the statutory language in CERCLA relating to the imposition of liability on parent corporations. There's nothing about U.S. v. Best Foods that fits the facts of this case. There's no legal basis for imposing liability on Baldwin & Sons, Inc., Baldwin & Sons, LLC, and Sunrise. Next slide. Further, Ms. Rubin didn't show you Atlantic Richfield Company. This is the only California case on this topic, and it's cited on this slide. Now, importantly, Atlantic Richfield is a California case which addresses the same issue in Best Foods. That's the operator liability issue, and it makes clear that liability can only be imposed on parent corporations. The facts of this case don't fit the holding of Best Foods or Atlantic Richfield. And the important thing is there is no case law, the prosecution team can't cite any, which suggests that you can impose liability on these entities. Let's go to the next slide. Ms. Rubin also told you that the law allows you to impose liability on three people, Mr. Capati, an employee, and Mr. Baldwin and Mr. Bone, who we acknowledge are corporate officers, at least of Sunrise Pacific Construction. She showed you this slide on the left. She cited the RCO test, and she told you you could use the RCO test to impose liability on Mr. Capati and the other two gentlemen. She didn't show you the whole test. Now, she told you that Jose Capati, although admittedly, and she admits, he's not a corporate officer, could have liability on this test because he had a position of responsibility. And she cited to this slide. Well, she omitted a critical part of the Roscoe decision test. And we've cited the language of Roscoe on the right, so you can see it. The first part of Roscoe, the part she didn't cite to, the part she omitted from her slide, is the three essential elements must be satisfied before liability will be imposed upon a corporate officer. And then it goes on to have it address the three prongs. Well, she didn't mention that part, that liability can only be imposed upon a corporate officer. In fact, she told you you could impose liability on someone who's not a corporate officer. Well, California law, the Roscoe decision, the one she cited, makes clear you can't do that. Mr. Capati wasn't a corporate officer. That's the evidence in this case. And Roscoe doesn't permit you to impose liability on somebody who is not a corporate officer. In fact, there's no law in California that allows you to do that. And if you the request that Ms. Rubin made to suggest you should impose liability on Mr. Capati, well, that's inviting legal error here. As for Mr. Bone and Mr. Baldwin, they were corporate officers of Sunrise Pacific Construction. We readily admit that. But Sunrise Pacific Construction was not the permittee. And as I just mentioned a minute ago, it doesn't have liability under the, quote, operator liability theory that Ms. Rubin talked about. So Mr. Bone and Mr. Baldwin's status as corporate officers, it doesn't give rise to liability under this theory that she's presented.
Mr. T, are you about to wrap up? I'm afraid you may be out of time.
I think this is my last slide. Let me just see. Is there one more? I won't. I don't have to discuss this. This is just the four orders that Ms. Rubin cited as further support for the responsible corporate officer doctrine. These aren't legal precedent, and they can't be relied upon. And that's all I have. I'm sorry if I went over by a minute or two. I tried my best to get it in time, and I appreciate your attention and patience listening to me. This is a complicated, and it's been a big case to work on, and it's taken a lot of effort to try to get arms around all of it. So I appreciate all of you putting in the effort to try to sort through this information and considering it all. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank both the prosecution team and the dischargers for their presentations today, as well as the advisory team in supporting our work. We've heard a lot. We'll go on break now, but we will reconvene at 1 to start our deliberations. So that will be on a Teams meeting, and that will be in executive session. Lori Okun, do you have anything to add to that?
Will any of the board members have any additional questions before we adjourn to closed session?
Mr. Anderson.
I just have a comment. During his summary, Mr. T said that I'd only seen 25 photos, which may be true of Mr. Melbourne, but I have reviewed the extensive number of photos in the record. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear, that we weren't limited, that I hadn't only been limited to the 25 photos. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And he speaks for all of us on this issue. Yes, I should have asked for questions, and I am remiss. Thank you very much, Lori. Any additional questions of anybody?
So the board's going to adjourn to closed session for deliberations. That's noticed on the agenda as item number 4. There's also some boilerplate in item number 5. The board's not going to be making a decision today, and they won't be issuing an order. We do need to adjourn back to open session to adjourn the meeting, but nothing's going to happen at that point. We'll come back onto Zoom, so the parties are welcome to monitor that if they'd like. And if I think of it, I'll try to send you an email before we do that. But this will be the end of the public part of the meeting for today.
Ms. Okun, are the discharger group allowed? Are we released? Is that what's happening?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure we don't have to stay on here. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And will you all have a Teams invitation in your calendar to log on to at 1? I see Dave Olson, Gibson has joined. Do you have anything you wish to address, Dave?
No, just logistically making sure everyone has the appointment or able to access it, and that everyone signs off on the Zoom meeting when we go to the Teams meeting, just to make sure there's no crossover.
And just to be clear, the Teams meeting is for the board members and the advisory team, not the parties.
Is it also in the email, the Teams meeting invite?
Yes, it'll be in your email box.
Okay, I didn't see it this morning. I apologize. Anyway. Okay.
See you then, 1:00.
Okay.
AGP and Chris, can you verify that we're recording and back on?
Yes, we are recording and broadcasting.
Great.
Hey, Travis, can you let me record? Please, can you give me permission to record, please? Thank you.
Let me see if we have a quorum. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Megan Blair is here. My video camera is not working for some reason.
Thank you, Megan. We have a quorum. So we're announcing that the Regional Board of San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board met in closed session to deliberate, and we took no action. And we are now closing this hearing. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.